and some of his own senior officials, like Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, were criticizing his Reconstruction policies for surrendering to the nigger vote and succumbing to radical influences. To his credit, during these tension-ridden months, Lincoln was always too much a politician to personalize things. He knew he needed the powerful Senate barons, the Sumners and the Wades, and he remained able to differentiate between mere glancing swipes of their criticisms and fatal blows. Yet the toll it took on him was often evident, in the deep lines crevicing his face, in the thick black rings that framed his eyes like a somnambulist's dark pouches, in his cold and clammy hands, and in his many bouts of depression. But Lincoln, always itching for progress, kept plugging away. He didn't dally. He didn't vacillate. He didn't become engrossed in minor matters or get bogged down in rigid ideology. Nor was he impatient, arrogant, or unfeeling. When he visited Richmond on April 3, he made another bold stab at hastening the war's end, meeting with the rebel Assistant Secretary of War, John A. Campbell. Even then, Lincoln desperately feared more bloodshed, and he had calculated that if Virginia withdrew from the Confederacy and made a speedy peace with the Union, her example might mobilize the rest of a ravaged South to follow suit. He promised Campbell that he would save any repenting sinner from hanging, and more significantly, tentatively authorized the rebel legislature to convene and help disband Virginia's troops and send them home. In the ensuing days, however, when word of his actions leaked out, his cabinet again howled in protest. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton and Attorney General James Speed in particular. This was heresy, they argued strenuously, tantamount to recognizing the rebel legislature as a legal body. Lincoln had thought he might at least get the support of his Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles. He didn't. Welles, too, objected in the strongest terms. Flabbergasted, the president was at first overly defensive about his actions, feebly contending that he had only authorized the gentlemen who have acted as the legislature, and denying that he ever intended to recognize them as a rightful body. He further protested that he was only trying to effect a reconciliation as soon as possible, and he shouldn't stickle about forms, provided he could attain the desired result. But with his entire cabinet again arrayed against him, he buckled, meekly admitting he had perhaps made a mistake. On April 12, he revoked the order. But perhaps never were his anxieties about Reconstruction and the waging of peace more apparent than on Tuesday, the evening of April 11. It is a paradoxical sight, for signs of celebration in the Union capital are everywhere. Despite a thick mist outside, the four corners of the city are illuminated. High atop its hill, the new Capitol dome is brilliantly lit and visible for miles. 3,500 victory candles shimmer beautifully in the windows of the government post office. Not to be outdone, 6,000 glow along the patent office. Across town, the high stately mansions of the rich and the powerful shine with gas lamps and fine candles, while eastward, the broken shanties of Negro settlements and the poorest alleys are proudly lit with the flickers of simple homemade beeswax. Far off in the distance, across the blackened Potomac, Robert E. Lee's home, Arlington, blinks like a million dazzling fireflies in the night, ablaze with colored candles and exploding rockets and the voice of thousands of ex-slaves singing the Yar of Jubilo. And in the city's epicenter, hundreds of people gather on the White House lawn, clogging Pennsylvania Avenue and filling the streets. Drunk and exuberant, they are waving banners and singing songs, and in call after call until their voices are hoarse, they summon the president once and for all to give a rousing, glorious speech about Union victory. Finally, Lincoln steps to the second-floor balcony window to cheers that surge and break and surge and break. Standing in the darkness like a ghostly apparition, with a lone candle held by an aide, he carefully begins to read his prepared text, which he has labored over in the last day. It is to be, the crowd expects, a thundering speech, one that will be locked forever triumphantly into the Unionist memory. Instead, however, it takes a most puzzling twist. "We meet this evening, not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart," he opens, adding, "The evacuation of Petersburg and Richmond and the surrender of the principal insurgent army give hope of a righteous and speedy peace." Thus, he quickly reminds the audience that the war is not yet over. Promising a day of national thanksgiving, he goes on to explain that the country will now face the trial of the reinauguration of the national authority, a task fraught with great difficulty, all the more so because of a small additional embarrassment. What is it? "That we, the loyal people, differ among ourselves as to the mode, manner, and means of reconstruction." The audience, once buzzing with animation, soon falls silent, even restive. This is a frustrating, peculiar address, not a stem-winding speech, but more the musings of a president obsessed with the knotty problems of Reconstruction. It is a defense and a turgid plea, and they take it like a song sung off-key. Lincoln continues, "Unlike the case of a war between independent nations, there is no authorized organ for us to treat with. No one man had authority to give up the rebellion for any other man. We simply must begin with, and mold from, disorganized and discordant elements." At great length, he then addresses his Republican critics, noting that they have already excoriated him for the interim state government that he has created in Louisiana, and are especially unhappy that blacks have not been given the vote. On this very day, in fact, Chief Justice Salmon Chase labels this act criminal. That may be so, but Lincoln explains that he personally prefers that very intelligent blacks and black soldiers should be given suffrage. Still, he protests, "Isn't it wiser to accept Louisiana with all its imperfections and improve it?" Now he cajoles the crowd. "There is much to commend Louisiana for already. It has a constitution that outlaws slavery, that grants blacks economic independence, that provides public school benefits equally for both races, and that empowers the legislature to enfranchise Negroes if it so chooses. Grant that the colored man deserves the elective franchise," he says, "will he not attain it sooner by saving the already advanced steps toward it than by running backward over them?" Moreover, he duly reminds his listeners, if his Republican critics reject Louisiana, they reject one more crucial vote for the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery. The mist changes to a drizzle, and soon it thickens into rain. By now, the tedium of the speech, it is actually somewhat pedantic and inelegant, drives some listeners off, one by one. Others shuffle their feet uneasily, recoiling at his mention of allowing blacks to vote. Lincoln then holds out an olive branch to his political adversaries. He notes that he is willing to meet them halfway. He is willing to be flexible about Reconstruction and work with the Congress. In fact, this is little more than political maneuvering. He intends to sidestep them altogether, privately asserting, "I think it providential that there are none of the disturbing elements of that body here to hinder and embarrass us." His plan for Louisiana is one plan, a plan, but not the only plan for reconstructing the other Confederate states. He is willing to retune and alter, fix and adjust, depending on the specific needs and circumstances of each state. "As bad promises are better broken than kept, I shall treat this as a bad promise and break it, whenever I shall be convinced that keeping it is adverse to the public interest. But," he cautions, "I have not yet been so convinced." Stressing that this situation is far from resolved, he closes with a mysterious caveat. "In the present situation, as the phrase goes, it may be my duty to make some new announcement to the people of the South. I am considering, and shall not fail to act, when satisfied that action will be proper. This final cryptic message again befuddles the crowd. Does it mean he will announce universal suffrage, amnesty for all rebels, his City Point Doctrine, a proclamation putting the entire South under military rule? As a puzzled murmur rolls through the audience, this question is left unanswered. Lincoln himself withdraws, again ghost-like, into the White House. Meanwhile, the crowd gives him only the most perfunctory applause. In truth, they are disappointed. They were hankering for a stirring oratory, a triumphant speech about the success of the Union armies, about the glorious sacrifices of Gettysburg, Cold Harbor, and Mare's Heights, about how their years of suffering had been proven right and were thusly being rewarded. They are not interested in the nagging problems of Louisiana or the particulars of Reconstruction more broadly. Tonight, they are even less interested in the president's dilemmas with Congress. Much of the crowd has already signaled its boredom and wandered off. Many others remaining fumed when Lincoln suggested limited Negro suffrage, both foolish and fanatical, they felt. To these people, and they were a considerable number, the country's troubles were Lincoln's doing, not the South's. Of these, one member of the audience, an actor by trade, feels particularly strongly, growling to his companion, "That means nigger citizenship. Now, by God, I'll put him through." Back inside the White House, Lincoln is not just once again exhausted, but very anxious about the cool reaction of the crowd. He is hardly any more reassured when he learns that the radicals, whom he sought to reach out to, have overwhelmingly rejected the compromises he offered in the address. One Boston journalist blasts him for his backwardness and argues that it will be wicked and blasphemous for us as a nation to allow any distinction of color whatever in the reconstructed states. For his part, speaking for the radicals from the Hill, Senator Sumner sternly agrees. "Alas, alas," he protests, "by failing to adopt a just and safe system of reconstruction, to wit, one that enfranchises all freedmen, the president is only promoting confusion and uncertainty in the future, with hot controversy." And to make matters worse, within his own cabinet there's also continued opposition. Salmon Chase, his Treasury Secretary for one, is unhappy that Lincoln is unwilling to endorse universal suffrage. However, Lincoln is in no mood to allow these temporary setbacks to thwart him, and by the time he meets with his cabinet 3 days later, on this morning of April 14, he intends to revisit the critical issue of post-war peace. "This is the great question before us," Lincoln announces, "and we must soon begin to act." For 3 hours across a green-topped table, they thrash the matter around. Once the war is over, Lincoln wants to establish normal commercial relations with the former Confederate states as soon as possible. The cabinet agrees. The executive agencies should resume their traditional functions in the South. The Treasury Department would proceed to collect revenues. The Interior Department would set its surveyors and land and pension agents to work. The Postmaster General would reestablish mail routes. This, too, meets with cabinet approval. Lincoln also informs his cabinet that he has given up on the idea of temporarily working with rebel legislatures, his Virginia proposal, acknowledging that he had been too fast in his desires for early Reconstruction. But he hastens to add that the reorganization of these states must not be directed from Washington. "We can't undertake to run state governments in all these southern states," he says. "Their people must do that, even if, at first, some of them may do it badly." There is a discussion about the appointment of military governors who would govern under martial law until civilian rule is reestablished. It is largely accepted that an army of occupation may be needed at first. Stanton recommends that Virginia and North Carolina be combined into a single military department, while Navy Secretary Gideon Welles strongly disagrees, saying that it would obliterate state boundaries. Lincoln agrees with Welles. He instructs Stanton to revise his proposal, making separate plans for Virginia and North Carolina. There is little doubt that Virginia occupies an important position in Lincoln's vision of the future Union. "We must not stultify ourselves as regards Virginia," he stresses, "but we must help her." Lincoln decides to defer the other more contentious matters of Reconstruction, like suffrage. But on one issue he is again adamant. There would be no war trials, no hangings or firing squads. As for the rebel leaders, his response is both emphatic and by now legendary. "Frighten them out of the country. Open the gates. Let down the bars. Scare them off," he says, waving his hands as if he were herding sheep. And contrary to his public pronouncements, Lincoln indicates that he is glad Congress is not in session to impede and impair their work. They have 8 months to get the Union reestablished before Congress comes together in December. What concerns him most about Congress is not their motives, which he labels good, but their feelings of hate and vindictiveness. This, he makes clear, can have no place in the future of the nation. Finally, the discussion drifts to the military situation. After Grant briefs the cabinet about Appomattox and the situation with Sherman in North Carolina, Lincoln comments on his dream last night about the phantom ship and the good news it surely prophesied. "I think it must be from Sherman," Lincoln says hopefully. "My thoughts are in that direction, as are most of yours." Though he does not know it yet, Lincoln's premonition is closer to right than wrong. William Tecumseh Sherman is about 20 miles above Raleigh, North Carolina, when he receives a message from General Joe Johnston requesting a truce to discuss terms of peace. Sherman is delighted, replying, "I am fully empowered to arrange with you any terms for suspension of hostilities between the armies." He adds that he hopes to extend to Johnston the same generous terms that Grant had given to Lee. The two commanding generals arrange to meet each other on April 17, between the Confederate position at Hillsboro and Sherman's headquarters. It will take 2 days for telegraph messages to get from Sherman's headquarters to Washington, but there is little doubt that this news, above all, will be a delight to Lincoln. It would mark the virtual end at last. Lincoln is so eager to hear the news from North Carolina that he has already trudged over to the War Department in the morning. But there was nothing. On this evening, after dinner, he will make a second quick trip, but there will still be no news from Sherman. After the cabinet meeting, Lincoln is too busy for lunch, munching on an apple instead. He returns to his office where he deals with the endless drudgery of the executive office, the constant stream of petitioners, the never-ending interviews, the pile of papers to be signed. Already he has had conversations with the Speaker of the House about the status of California and the Western Territories, a chat with the Postmaster of Detroit, a conference with a Maryland senator about a patronage matter, an audience with his newly appointed minister to Spain, and an interview with a Mississippi riverboat pilot whose cotton has been confiscated by the Confederates. He also meets with his vice president, Andrew Johnson, for the very first time since the day of the inaugural. At 3 o'clock, he breaks away from the press of activities to take a romantic carriage ride with Mary. It is now chill and blustery outside, and they huddle close together as the carriage bumps and rolls through the streets toward the Navy Yard. Lincoln is finally able to relax a bit, exuding uncommonly good spirits. "You seem so gay," Mary tells him, "so cheerful, almost joyous." "And well I may feel so," he says, thinking ahead. "I consider this the day the war has come to a close." Then, in a tender, conciliatory voice, he recalls the biting private troubles that they have experienced over the last 4 years. "We must both be more cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of our darling son, Willie, we have been very miserable." They talk about the future, about the years ahead and what they will do when Lincoln's second term is over. Unlike other presidents, such as George Washington, who was 65 at the end of his presidency, or Jefferson, who was 62, or Jackson, who was 70, Lincoln, at 56, is still a relatively young man with the prospect of a long life ahead of him. There will be, he says, travel to Europe with their sons, and perhaps even a visit to the Holy City in Palestine, which he had always wanted to see. There will be a journey out west, past the Rockies, and on to California, land of booming gold and silver mines. There will be a return home to the practice of law. As he once said to his partner, William Herndon, "If I live, I'm coming back sometime, and then we'll go right on practicing law as if nothing happened." And there will be the farm they might buy along the Sangamon. His spirits are so high that Mary laughs. "Dear husband, you almost startle me with your great cheerfulness." He tells her, "I have never felt better in my life." Sometime after 6, they return to the White House for an early dinner. Mary now complains of a headache and is inclined to stay at home. Lincoln, too, is tired, but says he needs to have a laugh over the country cousin and doesn't want to go to Ford's alone. In any event, if he were to remain in the White House, he explains, he would get no rest. Visitors would hound him all throughout the night. Indeed, a congressman, Isaac N. Arnold, is coming up unannounced to the White House at this very moment and will be turned away by the president. "I am going to the theater," Lincoln will tell him. "Come and see me in the morning." After dinner, on his second trip of the day to the War Department, Lincoln notices some quarrelsome drunkards in the street. Should Crook, his bodyguard, accompany him to the theater? Lincoln says no. He makes nothing of it, but then quietly tells Crook that there are men who want to take his life, and that if it were to be done, it would be impossible to prevent it. Returning to the White House, Lincoln charms Crook with a heartfelt smile. "You've had a long, hard day's work and must go home." They part at the portico of the White House as Lincoln calls out not his familiar "good night," but a more formal "goodbye," and saunters up the steps. The one question for Lincoln is who will accompany them to the theater. Earlier in the day, Grant begged off, muttering that he and his wife had plans to visit their sons in Burlington, New Jersey, and were catching an early train. Remarkably, Grant and his wife are the first of 13 people who will turn down Lincoln's invitation, including a number of visitors who have called upon him this morning. Governor Richard Oglesby and General Isham Haney, both from Illinois. Schuyler Colfax, the House Speaker, and his wife. William Howard, the Detroit Postmaster. William Wallace, the Governor of Idaho Territory, and his wife. War Secretary Edwin Stanton and his wife. Thomas Acreet, Chief of the Telegraph Bureau, and his wife. And even the Lincoln son Robert, who says he is too tired. Finally, Mary secures a handsome young couple to accompany them, the ebullient Major Henry Rathbone and young Clara Harris, his stepsister and fiancée, and also a friend of the First Lady's and the daughter of Senator Ira Harris of New York. Delayed by last-minute visitors, Lincoln and Mary hop into the presidential carriage some 15 minutes late, leaving around 8:15. Lincoln is wearing his customary black overcoat, his high silk hat, and white kid gloves, and Mary is clad in a smart, low-necked gray silk dress and matching bonnet. As the carriage slips out into the street, its large wooden wheels groaning and creaking, and makes its way to Senator Harris's place, gaslights flicker spookily in the streets. The sky is overcast, and it is so foggy out that as the Lincolns drive on, they can barely see through the moist air and wandering evening haze. Pedestrians become mere silhouettes, buildings disappear altogether, and it is nearly impossible to make out what lies beyond the next corner. Only Lincoln's personal attendant and the coachman are riding with them. Lincoln's guard for the evening, John F. Parker has already gone ahead. The carriage pulls up to the theater at 8:30. "This way to Ford's!" A barker outside is crying. "This way to Ford's!" The performance has been underway for 20 minutes. So the two couples quickly hurry inside, Mary Squired on Lincoln's arm, the attractive Clara Harris on Rathbone's. With the president leading the way, the two couples ascend the winding stairway and cross over the dress circle at the back of the first balcony. The theater is jammed with assorted Washington dignitaries, an array of generals and admirals, leading journalists like New York Times publisher Henry J. Raymond, and well-dressed Washington socialites. When they spot the president, the audience rises to its feet and gives him a standing ovation as the orchestra promptly strikes up "Hail to the Chief." The presidential party sweeps around the back row of chairs, passes through a door and down a short hallway to the state box. There is more cheering. The president acknowledges the applause with a slight bow and slides his tired frame into a comfortable upholstered rocking chair, specially provided by the management. Mary sits beside him, and Rathbone and Clara to their right. The front of their box is adorned with an eclectic jumble of celebration, vivid patriotic colors, the Union Treasury flag, and a fine handmade, gilt-framed portrait of George Washington. Below, Harry Hawke, the male lead, improvises. "This reminds me of a story, as Mr. Lincoln used to say." The audience claps and breaks out into a hearty roar. Mary soon rests her hand on her husband's knee and nestles close. "What will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?" she later whispers. Smiling, he replies, "She won't think anything about it." As the play continues, Lincoln's guard, John Parker, slips off from his post in the hallway outside the state box. Distinguished largely for his incorrigibility and incompetence, he will either watch the play from the gallery or exit for a quick drink. Left behind is the White House footman, Charles Forbes, who will also grab a quick drink during the intermission. Nobody notices the small peephole carved in the door. The comedy continues. It is about a conniving Englishwoman, Mrs. Mountchessington, who is thoroughly certain that Asa Trenchard, an American bumpkin, is actually a rich Yankee, whom she is determined to entrap as a husband for her daughter Augusta. The play weaves a mixture of melodramatic and farcical scenes, and the audience falls into one round of laughter after another. When the actors strike a mirthful chord, Mary applauds giddily, calling Lincoln's attention to the funniest lines. For his part, the president is more reserved. He does not clap, but from time to time, he does laugh heartily. At one point, he apparently feels a chill and rises just long enough to put on his overcoat. It is unclear whether he ever fully relaxes, but it is also clear that he is trying to lose himself in the play's odd duck humor. During the third act, Lincoln slips his hand into Mary's. At this point in the play, the horrible truth about Trenchard has been revealed. He has given away his inheritance and is church mouse poor, and most certainly is not fit for Mrs. Mountchessington's daughter. She angrily dispatches Augusta to her room and denounces the American for his ill manners and for being an awful social bore. "I am aware, Mr. Trenchard, that you are not used to the manners of good society, and that alone will excuse the impertinence of which you have been guilty." She, too, makes an indignant exit, leaving Asa alone on the stage. At roughly 10:07, outside the presidential box, an official-looking envelope is delivered to the White House footman, Charles Forbes. It is from S.P. Hanscom, a Lincoln ally and editor of the National Republican. Forbes takes it into the president, then returns to his position. It is now 5 minutes later. This time Forbes inspects a gentleman's calling card. A moment passes, and then the guest's hand is upon the door. There is no latch. He gives it a push, and it opens quietly to reveal a full view of Mary and Lincoln snuggling close. "Don't know the manners of a good society, eh?" Trenchard cries out on stage to Mrs. Mount Chessington. Watching this, Mary Lincoln is now smiling beautifully. And anticipating the punchline, Lincoln leans forward, with his chin cradled in his right hand and his arm resting on the balustrade. Mr. Trenchard continues, "Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal. You suck-dologizing old man-trap." The crowd bursts into laughter, and a round of applause, punctuated only by the lone, muffled sound of an otherwise loud noise, like a violent clap of hands, or the crack of wood, or perhaps a firecracker. Lincoln's arm jerks up convulsively. For a single terrible instant, nobody moves in the state box. Mary and Clara are frozen in their seats. Clara's dress, her hands, her face are saturated with blood. Then pandemonium breaks out. The audience, now looking around, wonders what is happening. Is it part of the play? Another improvised scene? Softly, a blue-white smoke drifts out of the presidential box. Suddenly, a man jumps from the state box onto the stage. He is immediately recognizable to most everyone there. He is the actor John Wilkes Booth. At that selfsame moment, the air is rent with a heartrending, incomprehensible shriek. And then come a woman's words, shouted at the top of her lungs, "The president is shot." Thus begins the choreographed decapitation of the Union government in Washington. No other attempt this bold has ever been carried out, before or since. As Lincoln slumps forward, the entire theater is enveloped in mayhem. People begin yelling hysterically, pushing one another into aisles, even rushing for the exits in fear that the assassination of the president might be the signal for a general massacre. They are not far from the truth. It is 10:15, and John Wilkes Booth's shooting of the Union president is but one of three coordinated assaults scheduled to take place at this very moment across the city. In addition to Lincoln, the Vice President, Andrew Johnson, is to be murdered. If both the President and Vice President are incapacitated, the Secretary of State will, according to the laws of the day, call a meeting of the electors the following December, a full 8 months away, to elect a new President and Vice President. And so William Seward, the Secretary of State, is also targeted. In the ensuing chaos and disorder that would surely follow, Booth reasoned, the Confederacy would be poised to take advantage, perhaps winning its independence yet. Shortly before 10:15, the second attack does take place, at Seward's elegant brick home at Lafayette Park, just across from the White House. It begins with the otherwise innocent ring of the doorbell. A tall, broad-shouldered, handsome man, nicely dressed, with a fine voice, and his hat pulled down over one eye, steps into the hallway, informing the servant that he is medicine for Mr. Seward and has been instructed to deliver it personally. A week earlier, Seward had been severely injured in a carriage accident and was suffering from facial lacerations, a fractured jaw, and a broken arm, and was lying in his bed covered with bandages, his neck awkwardly fixed in a steel brace. The servant explains that the secretary is to see no one, but the man talks his way past him. However, when he runs into the secretary's son, Frederick, in the upper hallway, the scheme appears to go awry. Here, the man is met with skepticism. Heated words are exchanged. Agreeing to leave, the man suddenly pulls a revolver out of his coat pocket and fires. By some quirk, it fails to go off, but he is unfazed. He violently pistol whips Frederick's head with a gun, shattering his skull and leaving him in a pool of blood. The man immediately pulls out a large bowie knife and rushes upstairs to Seward's room. This time he encounters Seward's daughter and renders her unconscious with a single powerful blow. A male army nurse now stands in his way. He, too, is quickly dispatched. the assassin slices his brow with a knife and knocks him senseless. Then, in the dimly lit room, he sees the secretary for the first time, lying immobilized and ailing. He raises his knife and thrusts again and again at Seward's face, looking to slash his jugular. Occasionally there is, or must be, a loud clang as the knife's edge pounds against the metal neck brace. Seward's throat is cut on both sides. His right cheek is nearly severed from his face. 3 times, his neck is stabbed. Moments later, the blood-stained secretary tumbles helplessly from the bed to the floor. Another of Seward's sons, Augustus, rushes into the room. He is stabbed 7 times. The army nurse has managed to pull himself to his feet, stumbles forward, and seeks to wrestle the man to the ground. The man stabs him 4 times. The assailant then runs out the front door, encountering a State Department messenger who has innocently walked into the carnage. Without hesitating, the man pumps the knife straight into the messenger's chest. "I'm mad!" he shouts. "I'm mad!" He rushes out the door into the night. Left behind, lying ominously on the floor, are the telltale signs of assassination: the man's slouch hat and the defective pistol. Seward's bandages are running with a fresh trail of crimson. His son Frederick, with 2 holes in his head, is already sinking into a coma. All told, the assailant leaves 5 casualties behind him, the most people ever targeted by a single American assassin. Unknown to any of the victims at the time, Booth's accomplice, this hulking man who has turned Seward's home into a war zone, is a shifty, low-browed Alabama native who was wounded at Gettysburg, deserted, and later rode with John Mosby, leaving under clouded circumstances. He is alternatively known as Lewis Powell, or the alias Lewis Payne, P-A-I-N-E, or Lewis Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, or yet another alias known as Reverend Wood. But whatever his name, he will now never be forgotten. A few blocks away, at 12th in Pennsylvania, the assassination of Vice President Andrew Johnson is set to take place at the same time. All seemed ready. That evening, an unsuspecting Johnson had eaten a leisurely meal in the dining room of the Kirkwood House. Afterward, he and Leonard Farwell, the former governor of Wisconsin, share an amiable chat. "Finally," Farwell announces, "I am going to the theater at Ford's. Would you like to come?" Johnson declines. He prefers to read in his room, then turn in. By 10 o'clock, the gas light is flicked off, and he is asleep in Suite 68, unaware that the third-floor room above houses his designated assassin, George Atzerodt. Atzerodt is a German immigrant and a carriage maker who, in his spare time, ferried Confederate spies across the Potomac. In his room lie the nefarious implements of conspiracy, kidnapping, and murder: a bankbook, coiled rope, and 2 carbines hidden between the mattress and the bedsprings. But tonight, he opts for a bowie knife, sheathed at his side. At 10 p.m., he enters the barroom of the hotel. In 15 minutes, he is to carry out the relatively straightforward plan: knock on Johnson's door and sink the knife deep into the vice president's heart. But at the last moment, Atzerodt gets cold feet. The would-be assassin instead wanders out into the streets and spends this night of mayhem and murder in a local tavern, nursing his nerves and getting drunk. Still, lead conspirator John Wilkes Booth has in fact anticipated a possible problem with Atzerodt. Earlier in the day, around 3:30, he had already visited the vice president's residence, Kirkwood House, and left a short note for Andrew Johnson. "Don't wish to disturb you," he slyly scribbled. "Are you at home? J. Wilkes Booth." The note was no doubt intended to throw suspicion on Johnson. While by some twist of fate, Johnson and Lincoln had met that day in the White House for the first time since the inauguration, it was well known that there was little love lost between the two men. Since Johnson would be in line to assume the presidential duties upon Lincoln's death, the note could be interpreted to mean that Johnson was in league with the conspirators. In either case, in the coming days, it would surely add to the confusion. In the next terror-stricken half hour, the Secretary of War, undressing himself, is told the president has been shot and Seward has been murdered. Within hours, drums are rolling, bugles sound, and the cavalry plunges into the city. Washington is now filled with military patrols who will pound throughout the streets on the lookout as guards stand tense watch outside the homes of all top government officials. When word of the multiple attacks seeps out, the northern capital is immediately stunned, paralyzed by the series of vicious attacks. Urgent rumors quickly sweep the city. There is widespread fear that the Confederates are trying to disrupt the northern government with a series of carefully planned assassinations. People are literally afraid of being killed in their beds. Others fear that in the middle of the chaos, rebel spies will torch the city. Martial law is quickly declared. Sometime after midnight, Grant, who could have also been shot in Ford's Theater, will be ordered to return immediately to Washington to defend the Capitol. By next morning, an overly distraught Mrs. Seward, weeping, will tell Senator Sumner, "They have murdered my husband! They have murdered my son!" By noontime that next day, the Secretary of War will even send a dire note warning General Sherman, "An assassin is on your track." Clearly, at first blush, Booth's plans to sow chaos have more than worked. The ugly seed of assassination appeared to be falling on fertile ground. In the meantime, all attention in the beleaguered northern capital turns to saving Abraham Lincoln, on whom so much depends. Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was an American original. His genius is unquestioned. His niche in history, and it is a large one, is secure, and so is his place in our affections. It is hardly possible to talk about the North's effort to win the war, and just as importantly, to secure a compassionate peace, separate from Lincoln. There was always something lofty, something different, something special about the tall, lanky president. He emanated a kind of parochial grandeur, itself rather unique in this country's annals. To be sure, there were many domineering men in Lincoln's time whose own fame frequently eclipsed his. Tsar Alexander II and Otto von Bismarck, Prince Metternich and Benjamin Disraeli, Giuseppe Garibaldi and Auguste Comte, and domineering women too, like Queen Victoria. But in our day, Lincoln now seems to rise above, a looming hero somehow residing on a different moral plane. As is the case with many historic figures, it is futile to expect consistency in his genius, and he abounds with contradictions. But they served him well. He was a politician in the crudest sense of the term, but at the same time a man of moral stature. He was a genuine intellectual, but also a man of uncommon street sense. He had no executive experience whatsoever, and only the most modest preparation for the highest office in the land. But when the country was suddenly confronted by the mightiest challenge since its auspicious birth, he somehow managed to ascend to the occasion. He was a figure who could give heroic life to what the Union was and, just as importantly, to what it might become. And perhaps most strikingly, he was a leader of such inexhaustible magnanimity and vision that by April 1865, he could put himself in a position of finally rescuing not just the North's depleted and bloodied young men, but in his own distinct manner and his own distinct way, those of the South as well. None of this was apparent in the beginning of his life. None of this was so starkly apparent, for that matter, until perhaps that single instant when Lincoln's arm abruptly jerked and his head slumped while a bullet lodged in his brain, and he waged the last, most desperate fight of his life. In truth, From his earliest years, Lincoln was always a riddle of quirks and impenetrable eccentricities. The New York Times even called him peculiar. Yet from those earliest years, it seemed as though the stage of his life was always set for high drama, if not towering tragedy. "Everybody in the world knows Pa used to split rails," Lincoln's little son, Taddy, used to say. Certainly, Lincoln was hardly the first politician to be born of humble origins, nor the first to mind them. But few have matched his meteoric rise, and fewer still have retained such deep links to their beginnings. Even when he had tasted the pinnacle of political success, Abraham Lincoln remained a self-made man, a middle American man, or so goes the standard Lincoln yarn. But unlike a George Washington, he did not need a Parson Weems to make his life a legend, for it was Lincoln himself who first authored his own tale, one that he acted out with great fervor. And it is in Lincoln that one finds that rarest of events, the nexus where legend and life often, though not always, meet. "I was born and have ever remained," he explained in his first campaign speech, "in the most humble walks of life. I have no popular relations or friends to recommend me." Thereafter his theme became, "I presume you all know who I am. I am humble Abraham Lincoln." His self-derogation was real. "My poor, lean, lank face." So was his simplicity. His clothes were invariably out of season or fashion. He referred to himself as A and greeted visitors with howdy. He stuffed notes in his pockets and stuck bills in a drawer. And his two most memorable speeches, at Gettysburg and his second inaugural, together total fewer than 1,000 words. He had always insisted that he came from nowhere, telling his biographer, John Locke Scripps of the Chicago Tribune, that his early life could be condensed into a single sentence, "the short and simple annals of the poor." This much was quite true. He was born in a log cabin in Kentucky, where his father had even done a stint on the Hardin County Slave Patrol, and spent his early life on a succession of frontier farms as his family, like thousands of others at the start of the 19th century, chased their futures west. His father knew enough to sign his name, though scarcely more than that, so it was his mother who taught him to read. But she died when he was 9. After that, he largely taught himself. He had 1 year of formal schooling. In the years that followed, the elder Lincoln, Thomas, hired his own son out for wages until Abe was finally able to work for himself. In the backwoods of Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois, and also along the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, Lincoln grew to be unusually tall, 6'4", 170 pounds, and learned a myriad of trades: rafting, carpentry, boating, forestry, butchering, brewing, distilling, plowing, storekeeping, and, naturally, rail splitting. But he would shrewdly turn these modest beginnings into political assets later on. As local settlers once jibed, he was a wild harum-scarum kind of man who always had his eyes open to the main chance. That main chance came first in education. Lincoln's innate intellect was apparent from his earliest years. He borrowed a copy of Kirkham's English Grammar and struggled to master his own tongue. He devoured the great works of history, literature, and biography, and delved into a host of others: Gibbon, Paine, and Volney, Robinson Crusoe and Aesop, The Pilgrim's Progress, and Weems's Lives of Washington and Franklin. Most importantly for his later career, he was inspired by Thomas Jefferson, Henry Clay, and Daniel Webster, three giants of American politics and history. Constantly seeking to improve himself, he practiced polemics, recited poetry, and taught himself mathematics. Yet while he was a voracious reader, he was not an instinctual but a political one. Thus, when his law partner tried to interest him in the works of Darwin, Spencer, and other literary writers, He scoffed that it was entirely too heavy for an ordinary mind to digest. He had little interest in fiction, and surprisingly, not much more in history or biography. When he did read, he read aloud, because it enabled him to understand things better. And for his larger edification, he relied on more than simple book learning. Accordingly, despite his modest station in life, he traveled a fair bit, which gave him keen insights into his country that many of his later, more refined colleagues sorely lacked. This, of course, in itself says something about Lincoln. Travel throughout much of America was difficult and usually expensive, and the majority of Americans knew little about the state of society beyond the nestled confines of their own towns, let alone their region. Senator Charles Sumner never once set foot in the South. Jefferson Davis visited New England only once. Yet Lincoln rafted down to New Orleans and worked his way back on a steamer. All told, he visited the South several times, and unlike most Northerners, knew it and knew it well. Physically, he was a strong man. Once, he lifted a barrel of whiskey from the floor to the counter. Another time, as president, he grabbed an axe and began chopping wood, to the utter astonishment of the gawking Union soldiers who watched him. He was flat-footed and stoop-shouldered, with a peculiar gait, until he decided, for effect, to stand tall, holding his head high and regal. The trademark stovepipe hat only accentuated a stature that was already outsized. But underneath all this, he was ridden with profound emotional swings, less up and more down. Early in his career, mortified by the humbling anonymity of Congress, he returned home and became brooding, withdrawn, beset by the specter of death and obsessed by his own anxieties. Overcome by a terrible fit of melancholy so profound, the characterization as Beveridge's, that the depths of it cannot be sounded or estimated by normal minds, he called it the hypo, or hypochondria, or his tired spot, even writing an essay on suicide. I may seem to enjoy life rapturously when I am in company, but when I am alone, I am so often overcome by mental depression that I never dare carry a penknife. Perhaps to balance this, he became a genius at storytelling, often addressing complex political situations with a simple quip, a revealing tale, an illustrative homily, even a smutty story. More often than not, storytelling was his broadsword, satire his rapier, and it always had a point. He had his run of bad luck. He set up a store, which failed, then set up as a postmaster, but was unable to make a living at that. When a circuit court issued a judgment against him for overdue notes, the sheriff attached his personal possessions, even his horse. Then his store partner died. Forced to shoulder the hefty $1,100 burden of remaining debt, Lincoln spent 15 years paying it off. His first lady friend, Anne Rutledge, died suddenly of an attack of brain fever. His first love, Mary Owens, turned him down. Later, like many an ambitious politician, he eventually did marry well, joining with Mary Todd, who came from an aristocratic and educated Kentucky family. But from the start, the relationship had a bit of the quality of an arrangement. Mary, plump and witty, cultured and French-speaking, knew politics and knew ambition. She had picked Lincoln out as destined for the White House. "Mr. Lincoln is to be President of the United States someday. If I had not thought so, I would not have married him, for you can see he is not pretty." For his part, Lincoln once quipped about Mary, "For God, one D is enough, but the Todds need two." In fact, the marriage almost never took place. Lincoln, insecure about his lack of pedigree and shunned by her family, at first begged off. But the 33-year-old Lincoln and the 23-year-old Mary eventually did tie the knot. Still, Lincoln's bad luck continued into their marriage. They had four sons, and two died tragically, including their much-beloved Willie, who passed away of a fatal illness in 1862 while Lincoln was president. It nearly broke both their hearts. The marriage was a curious one, and in countless ways, the two couldn't have been more different. He loved humor, she had none at all. He grew up on dirt floors, she was served by slaves and attended finishing school. She was neat and fastidious, he was rumpled and disorganized, both at home and at the office. She insisted upon servants, he often did not file and would not keep a clerk. And if he was disconsolate, she could also be nasty and difficult. Acrimony, too, frequently crept into the Lincoln home. More than once, she drove him from the house in anger, at least once while brandishing a broomstick. Another time, she chased him down the street while waving a knife. Yet there was a deep root of tenderness in their marriage, and over time, she came both to understand his awkwardness and to respect his righteousness. In turn, he relied on her, far more than is often credited by history. When he repeatedly failed in his quest for Congress, she pushed, prodded, and propped him up. Absent that, the depressive and often distraught Lincoln might well have quit. It is equally likely that without her, the presidency might also have eluded him. For his part, he attempted to behave decently toward her. And he loved her, affectionately naming her My Molly, fussing over her as My Child Wife and My Little Woman. Once she was in the White House, beset by her own deep and near debilitating moods and disappointments, it was clear that she understood the inner Lincoln as did no one else around him. And this was a two-way street. His familial empathy no doubt helped imbue him with equal empathy for the South. No fewer than 4 of her brothers and 3 brothers-in-law fought for the Confederacy. 2 were killed in battle. Although during his presidency, she would fall under the spell of her good friend Senator Sumner and become a far more ardent advocate of abolition than her husband. By way of a profession, Lincoln was a self-taught lawyer and a successful one at that, earning up to $5,000 a year by the 1850s. But law per se never held much appeal for him. Politics did. Not the Jacksonian Democrats of his father, which he rejected, but the new roads, central banking, and protective tariffs of the National Republicans and Whigs. From the start, Lincoln saw his role as a champion of the budding middle class. "Republicans," he memorably put it, "are both for the man and the dollar." He gave his first stump speech at 19, and the pleasant taste stayed with him long after that. Politics were his life, newspapers his food, and his great ambition his mode of power. His law partner Herndon wrote, "At 23, only 7 months after coming to the little Illinois community of New Salem, Lincoln was already running for office. He lost. But contrary to the way he liked to tell it, success soon came to him. 2 years later, in 1834, Sangamon County sent him to the Lower Illinois House. From this time on to the end of his life, except for the years between 1849 and 1854, when his political prospects were at their lowest ebb, he was either campaigning, serving in office, or out on the stump for other office seekers. But ultimately, it was not through Lincoln's middle-class mantra or his fiercely partisan wiggery that he would make his lasting political mark. It was slavery, human bondage, and human servitude. By some combination of design and fate, the slavery issue would not let Lincoln stray from public life, not let him fade into obscurity, not let him rest. Lincoln legend has it at the age of 21, on his second trip to New Orleans, he saw a handsome mulatto girl being sold on the block at the slave market. It was then that the iron entered his soul, and he swore henceforth that, if he ever got a chance to, he would hit slavery and hit it hard. The authenticity of this tale is suspect, but what is not suspect are the sentiments that haunted him. The image of the strutting slave owner, of the degraded young woman, of the utter scorn in which slavery held freedom. Time and again, from then on, his personal insights about slavery were deep and penetrating. Slavery was a dangerous, slippery slope, he contended, not simply an affront to freedom, not simply as an affront to democracy, not simply corrupting the South, but corrupting human relations everywhere. consider this Lincoln musing. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may of right enslave B, why may not B snatch the same argument, even proven equally that he may enslave A? You say A is white and B is black? Is it color, then, the lighter having the right to enslave the darker? Take care. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet, with a fairer skin than your own. You do not mean color, exactly. You mean the whites are intellectually the superior of the blacks, and therefore have the right to enslave them? Take care again. By this rule, you are to be the slave of the first man you meet, with an intellect superior to your own. But Lincoln's private hostility to slavery belies another significant record, that of public vacillation, even accommodation. And here lies one of the great questions about Lincoln the politician versus Lincoln the principled leader. In political life, Lincoln was careful never to step too far ahead of prevailing opinion. He frequently calculated and fudged. His explanations were often wry and not always convincing, and he was not above pandering and manipulating both facts and opinions. Yet because he was always cautious and instinctively conservative, his public actions concerning slavery invariably stand in bewildering contrast to his keen insights into, and his equally keen onslaughts against, pro-slavery arguments. Thus, despite his opposition to the peculiar institution, Lincoln outwardly maintained that slavery was destined to gradually disappear on its own, a victim of its own internal contradictions and of historical progress. And, in this sense, he was like a number of Southerners, including his political and intellectual idol, Thomas Jefferson, who tolerated the institution while quietly holding their noses. It would prove to be a chimerical hope, but that realization would come to him only much later and after no small measure of public evasion. I hold it a paramount duty of us in the free states, due to the union of the states, and perhaps to liberty itself, to let slavery of the other states alone. While, on the other hand, I hold it equally clear that we should never knowingly lend ourselves to prevent slavery from dying a natural death. This fence-sitting bore a peculiar fruit. As a lame-duck congressman, I was a nobody, he reminds us. In 1849, Lincoln got his first chance to take a crack at the institution he so reviled, drafting a bill to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. It was to be enacted by local referendum, but the politician in him led Lincoln to soften the blow, adding a section that required municipal authorities of Washington and Georgetown to provide active and efficient means of arresting and restoring to their owners all fugitive slaves escaping into the district. In effect, the bill sought to split the difference between the two extremes of slave owners and slaver haters. But in seeking to offend nobody, Lincoln only ended up offending everyone. As soon as his plans were made public, all support for the measure vanished. The bill failed, yet when the House took it upon itself to debate the morality of slavery nonetheless, Lincoln sat by, mute and silent. He spent the next 5 years in much the same state, back in Illinois, practicing law, unhappily watching events pass him by. It was the pugnacious little giant Stephen Douglas who, in 1854, opened the door that let Lincoln back into public life. Early that year, Douglas unveiled the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which put the question of extending bondage in the new territories to a majority vote. Watching the debate unfold, Lincoln saw a chance for himself. Now it was to be on the back of slavery that this failed one-term congressman would seek to rehabilitate his political fortunes. But here again, his moral zeal sometimes wrestled uneasily with his political pragmatism. Initially, Lincoln took great pains in all his speeches to emphasize that he was not an abolitionist, nor was he advocating political or social equality for blacks. He merely opposed extending slavery into the new territories. He knew all too well that most of his supporters were not only not abolitionists, but were outright negrophobes, who did not want to live or work alongside blacks, free or slave. But he could not equivocate for long. On May 29, 1856, his moment descended. Called upon to deliver the adjournment speech at the convention inaugurating the new Illinois Republican Party, Lincoln now staked everything in kind. Discarding his usual timidity, he finally made good on his much earlier promise to hit slavery and hit it hard. It was the best speech of his life, a stunning oration so mesmerizing that reporters ceased scratching away, and for some time it was lost. Actually, the only existing version of the speech is not verbatim. Even his close friend and legal partner, Herndon, a prodigious note-taker,